He picked her up. I don't know how much effort it cost him, but he did. And the oddest thing, Kai let herself be picked up. He was a complete stranger to her, and old people always seemed to scare little children, but she let him pick her up. "Do you know who I am?" he asked her. She shook her head, but the way she was looking at him, it was as if she almost knew. "Do you think that's possible?"
"Yes."
He said, "I'm your grandpa." And I almost grabbed her back, Mike, because I had this crazy idea, I don't know,
that he was going to eat her up.
Her cigarette paused in front of her mouth. Her eyes were round. "How do you know that? How can you know that?"
"Because in my mind's eye, it looks like a fairy tale. Little Red Riding Hood and the old gray wolf.
What did he do then?" "Ate her up with his eyes. Since then, he's taught her to play checkers and Candyland and box dots. She's only three, but he's taught her to add and subtract. She has her own room at Warrington's and her own little computer in it, and God knows what he's taught her to do with that. But that first time, he only looked at her. It was the hungriest look I've ever seen in my life. And she looked back. It couldn't have been more than 10 or 20 seconds, but it seemed like forever. Then he tried to hand her back to me. He'd used up all his strength, though, and if I hadn't been right there to take her, I think he would have dropped her on the cement walk. He staggered a little, and Roget Whitmore put an arm around him. That was when he took the oxygen mask from her. There was a little red air bottle attached to it on an elastic, and put it over his mouth and nose. A couple of deep breaths, and he seemed more or less all right again. He gave it back to Roget and really seemed to see me for the first time. He said, "I've been a fool, haven't I?" I said, "Yes, sir, I think you have." He gave me a look, very black, when I said that. I think if he'd been even 5 years younger, he might have hit me for it.
But he wasn't, and he didn't.
"No," he said.
"I want to go inside. Will you help me do that?"
I said I would. We went up the mortuary steps with Roget on one side of him, me on the other, and Kyra walking along behind. I felt sort of like a harem girl. It wasn't a very nice feeling. When we got in the vestibule, he sat down to catch his breath and take a little more oxygen. Roget turned to Kyra. "I think that woman's got a scary face. It reminds me of some painting or other."
"The Scream? The one by Munch?"
"I'm pretty sure that's the one."
She dropped her cigarette. She'd smoked it all the way down to the filter and stepped on it, grinding it into the bony, rock-riddled ground with one white sneaker.
But Kai wasn't scared of her a bit. Not then, not later. She bent down to Kyra and said, "What rhymes with lady?" And Kyra said, "Shady," right off. Even at 2, she loved rhymes. Roget reached into her purse and brought out a Hershey's Kiss. Kai looked at me to see if she had permission, and I said, "All right, but just one, and I don't want to see any of it on your dress." Kai popped it into her mouth and smiled at Roget as if they'd been friends since forever. By then, DeVore had his breath back, but he looked tired, the most tired man I've ever seen. He reminded me of something in the Bible, about how, in the days of our old age, we say we have no pleasure in them. My heart kind of broke for him. Maybe he saw it because he reached for my hand. He said, "Don't shut me out." And at that moment, I could see Lance in his face. I started to cry. I said, "I won't unless you make me."
I could see them there in the funeral home's foyer, him sitting, her standing, the little girl looking on in wide-eyed puzzlement as she sucked the sweet Hershey's Kiss, canned organ music in the background. Poor old Max DeVore had been crafty enough on the day of his son's viewing, I thought. Don't shut me out, indeed. "I tried to buy you off, and when that didn't work, I upped the stakes and tried to buy the baby. When that also failed, I told my son that you and he and my grandchild could choke on the dirt of your own decision. In a way, I'm the reason he was where he was when he fell and broke his neck, but don't shut me out, Maddie. I'm just a poor old geezer, so don't shut me out."
I was stupid, wasn't I?
You expected him to be better than he was. If that makes you stupid, Maddie, the world could use more of it.
I did have my doubts, she said. It's why I wouldn't take any of his money, and by last October he'd quit asking. But I let him see her. I suppose, yeah, part of it was the idea there might be something in it for Kai later on. But I honestly didn't think about that so much. Mostly it was him being her only blood link to her father. I wanted her to enjoy that the way any kid enjoys having a grandparent. What I didn't want was for her to be infected by all the crap that went on before Lance died. At first it seemed to be working. Then, little by little, things changed. I realized that Kai didn't like her white papa so much, for one thing. Her feelings about Rogetta the same, but Mac's divorce started to make her nervous in some way I don't understand and she can't explain. I asked her once if he'd ever touched her anywhere that made her feel funny. I showed her the places I meant, and she said no. I believe her, but he said something or did something. I'm almost sure of it. Could be no more than the sound of his breathing getting worse, I said. That alone might be enough to scare a child. Or maybe he had some kind of spell while she was there. What about you, Maddie? Well, one day in February, Lindy Briggs told me that George Footman had been in to check the fire extinguishers and the smoke detectors in the library. He also asked if Lindy had found any beer cans or liquor bottles in the trash lately, or cigarette butts that were obviously homemade. Roaches, in other words. Uh-huh. And Dickie Osgood has been visiting my old friends, I hear. Chatting. Panning for gold. Digging the dirt. Is there any to dig? Not much, thank God. I hoped she was right, and I hoped that if there was stuff she wasn't telling me, John Storrow would get it out of her. But through all this, you let Kai go on seeing him. What would pulling the plug on the visits have accomplished? And I thought that allowing them to go on would at least keep him from speeding up any plans he might have. That, I thought, made a lonely kind of sense. Then, in the spring, I started to get some extremely creepy, scary feelings. Creepy how? Scary how? I don't know. She took out her cigarettes, looked at them, then stuffed the pack back in her pocket. It wasn't just that my father-in-law was looking for dirty laundry in my closets, either. It was Kai. I started to worry about Kai all the time she was with him. With them. Rogette would come in the BMW they'd bought or leased, and Kai would be sitting out on the steps waiting for her, with her bag of toys if it was a day visit, with her little pink Minnie Mouse suitcase if it was an overnight. And she'd always come back with one more thing than she left with. My father-in-law's a great believer in presents. Before popping her into the car, Rogette would give me that cold little smile of hers and say, 7 o'clock, then, we'll give her supper. Or, 8 o'clock, then, and a nice hot breakfast before she leaves. I'd say okay, and then Rogette would reach into her bag and hold out a Hershey's Kiss to Kai just the way you'd hold a biscuit out to a dog to make it shake hands. She'd say a word, and Kyra would rhyme it. Rogette would toss her her treat. Woof, woof, good dog, I always used to think. And off they'd go. Come 7 in the evening or 8 in the morning, the BMW would pull in right where your car's parked now. You could set your clock by the woman. But I got worried. That they might get tired of the legal process and just snatch her? This seemed to me a reasonable concern. So reasonable I could hardly believe Maddie had ever let her little girl go to the old man in the first place. In custody cases, as in the rest of life, possession tends to be 9/10 of the law. And if Maddie was telling the truth about her past and present, a custody hearing was apt to turn into a tiresome production even for the rich Mr. DeVore. Snatching might, in the end, look like a more efficient solution. Not exactly, she said. I guess it's the logical thing, but that wasn't really it. I just got afraid. There was nothing I could put my finger on. It would get to be 6:15 in the evening, and I'd think, this time that white-haired bitch isn't going to bring her back. This time she's going to... I waited. When nothing came, I said, going to what? I told you, I don't know, she said. But I've been afraid for Kai since spring. By the time June came around, I couldn't stand it anymore, and I put a stop to the visits. Kyra's been off and on pissed at me ever since. I'm pretty sure that's most of what that 4th of July escapade was about. She doesn't talk about her grandfather very much, but she's always popping out with, "What do you think the white Nana's doing now, Maddie?" Or, "Do you think the white Nana would like my new dress?" Or she'll run up to me and say, "Sing, ring, king, thing," and ask for a treat. What was the reaction from DeVore? Complete fury. He called again and again, first asking what was wrong, then making threats. Physical threats? Custody threats. He was going to take her away. When he was finished with me, I'd stand before the whole world as an unfit mother. I didn't have a chance. My only hope was to relent and let me see my granddaughter, goddammit. I nodded. "Please don't shut me out. Doesn't sound like the guy who called while I was watching the fireworks, but that does." "I've also gotten calls from Dickie Osgood and a number of other locals," she said, "including Lance's old friend, Richie Lattimore. Richie said I wasn't being true to Lance's memory." "What about George Footman?" "He cruises by once in a while. Lets me know he's watching. He hasn't called or stopped in. You asked about physical threats. Just seeing Footman's cruiser on my road feels like a physical threat to me. He scares me. But these days it seems as if everything does. Even though Kyra's visits have stopped. Even though. It feels thundery, like something's going to happen. And every day that feeling seems to get stronger." "Mr. Storrow's number," I said. "Do you want it?" She sat quietly, looking into her lap. Then she raised her head and nodded. "Give it to me, and thank you, from the bottom of my heart." I had the number on a pink memo slip in my front pocket. She grasped it, but did not immediately take it. Our fingers were touching, and she was looking at me with disconcerting steadiness. It was as if she knew more about my motives than I did myself. "What can I do to repay you?" she asked. And there it was. "Tell Starro everything you've told me." I let go of the pink slip and stood up. "That'll do just fine, and now I have to get along. Will you call and tell me how you made out with him?" "Of course." We walked to my car. I turned to her when we got there. For a moment, I thought she was going to put her arms around me and hug me, a thank you gesture that might have led anywhere in our current mood, one so heightened it was almost melodramatic. But it was a melodramatic situation, a fairy tale where there's good and bad and a lot of repressed sex running under both. Then headlights appeared over the brow of the hill where the market stood and swept past the all-purpose garage. They moved toward us, brightening. Maddie stood back and actually put her hands behind her like a child who has been scolded. The car passed, leaving us in the dark again, but the moment had passed too, if there had been a moment. "Thanks for dinner," I said. "It was wonderful." "Thanks for the lawyer. I'm sure he'll be wonderful, too," she said, and we both laughed. The electricity went out of the air. "He spoke of you once, you know. DeVore." I looked at her in surprise. I'm amazed he even knew who I was. Before this, I mean. "He knows all right. He spoke of you with what I think was genuine affection." "You're kidding. You must be." "I'm not. He said that your great-grandfather and his great-grandfather worked the same camps and were neighbors when they weren't in the woods. I think he said not far from where Boyd's Marina is now. They shit in the same pit, is the way he put it." "Charming, huh?" "He said he guessed that if a couple of loggers from the TR could produce millionaires, the system was working the way it was supposed to. Even if it took three generations to do it," he said. At the time, I took it as a veiled criticism of Lance. "It's ridiculous, however he meant it," I said. "My family is from the coast, Prout's Neck, other side of the state. My dad was a fisherman, and so was his father before him. My great-grandfather, too. They trapped lobsters and threw nets. They didn't cut trees." All that was true, and yet my mind tried to fix on something, some memory connected to what she was saying. Perhaps if I slept on it, it would come back to me. "Could he have been talking about someone in your wife's family?" "Nope. There are Arlens in Maine. They're a big family, but most are still in Massachusetts. They do all sorts of things now, but if you go back to the 1880s, the majority would have been quarrymen and stonecutters in the Malden Lynn area. DeVore was pulling your leg, Maddie." But even then, I suppose I knew he wasn't. He might have gotten some part of the story wrong. Even the sharpest guys begin to lose the edge of their recollection by the time they turn 85. But Max DeVore wasn't much of a leg puller. I had an image of unseen cable stretching beneath the surface of the earth here on the TR, stretching in all directions, unseen but very powerful. My hand was resting on top of my car door, and now she touched it briefly. "Can I ask you one other question before you go? It's stupid, I warn you." "Go ahead. Stupid questions are a specialty of mine." "Do you have any idea at all what that Bartleby story is about?" I wanted to laugh, but there was enough moonlight for me to see she was serious and that I'd hurt her feelings if I did. She was a member of Lindy Briggs's Reader's Circle, where I had once spoken in the late 80s, probably the youngest by at least 20 years, and she was afraid of appearing stupid. "I have to speak first next time," she said, "and I'd like to give more than just a summary of the story so they know I've read it. I've thought about it until my head aches, and I just don't see. I doubt if it's one of those stories where everything comes magically clear in the last few pages, either. And I feel like I should see that it's right there in front of me." That made me think of the cables again. Cables running in every direction. A subcutaneous webwork connecting people and places. You couldn't see them, but you could feel them. Especially if you tried to get away. Meanwhile, Maddie was waiting, looking at me with hope and anxiety. "Okay, listen up. School's in session," I said. "I am, believe me." Most critics think Huckleberry Finn is the first modern American novel, and that's fair enough. But if Bartleby was 100 pages longer, I think I'd put my money there. "Do you know what a scrivener was?" "A secretary?" "That's too grand. A copyist, sort of like Bob Cratchit in A Christmas Carol. Only Dickens gives Bob a past and a family life. Melville gives Bartleby neither. He's the first existential character in American fiction, a guy with no ties. No ties to, you know, a couple of loggers who could produce millionaires. They shit in the same pit." "Mike?" "What?" "Are you okay?" "Sure." I focused my mind as best I could. Bartleby is tied to life only by work. In that way, he's a 20th-century American type, not much different from Sloane Wilson's Man in the Gray Flannel Suit or, in the dark version, Michael Corleone in The Godfather. But then Bartleby begins to question even work, the god of middle-class American males. She looked excited now, and I thought it was a shame she'd missed her last year of high school, for her and also for her teachers. "That's why he starts saying, 'I prefer not to'?" "Yes. Think of Bartleby as a hot air balloon. Only one rope still tethers him to the earth, and that rope is his scrivening. We can measure the rot in that last rope by the steadily increasing number of things Bartleby prefers not to do. Finally, the rope breaks, and Bartleby floats away. It's a goddamn disturbing story, isn't it?" "One night I dreamed about him," she said. "I opened the trailer door, and there he was, sitting on the steps in his old black suit. Thin, not much hair. I said, 'Will you move, please? I have to go out and hang the clothes now.' And he said, 'I prefer not to.' Yes, I guess you could call it disturbing." "Then it still works," I said, and got into my car. "Call me. Tell me how it goes with John Storrow." "I will, and anything I can do to repay, just ask." "Just ask. How young did you have to be, how beautifully ignorant, to issue that kind of blank check?" My window was open. I reached through it and squeezed her hand. She squeezed back and hard. "You miss your wife a lot, don't you?" she said. "It shows?" "Sometimes." She was no longer squeezing, but she was still holding my hand. "When you were reading to Kai, you looked both happy and sad at the same time. I only saw her once, your wife, but I thought she was very beautiful." I had been thinking about the touch of our hands, concentrating on that. Now I forgot about it entirely. "When did you see her? And where? Do you remember?" She smiled as if those were very silly questions. "I remember. It was at the ball field on the night I met my husband." Very slowly, I withdrew my hand from hers. So far as I knew, neither Joe nor I had been near TR-90 all that summer of 94. But what I knew was apparently wrong. Joe had been down on a Tuesday in early July. She had even gone to the softball game. "Are you sure it was Joe?" I asked. Maddie was looking off toward the road. It wasn't my wife she was thinking about. I would have bet the house and lot on it. Either house, either lot. It was Lance. Maybe that was good. If she was thinking about him, she probably wouldn't look too closely at me, and I didn't think I had much control of my expression just then. She might have seen more on my face than I wanted to show. "Yes," she said. "I was standing with Jenna McCoy and Helen Geary. This was after Lance helped me with a keg of beer. I got stuck in the mud and then asked if I was going for pizza with the rest of them after the game. And Jenna said, 'Look, it's Mrs. Noonan.' And Helen said, 'She's the writer's wife, Maddie. Isn't that a cool blouse?' The blouse was all covered with blue roses. I remembered it very well. Joe liked it because it was a joke. There are no blue roses, not in nature and not in cultivation. Once, when she was wearing it, she had thrown her arms extravagantly around my neck, swooned her hips forward against mine, and cried that she was my blue rose and I must stroke her until she turned pink. Remembering that hurt, and badly. She was over on the third base side, behind the chicken wire screen, Maddie said, with some guy who was wearing an old brown jacket with patches on the elbows. They were laughing together over something, and then she turned her head a little and looked right at me. She was quiet for a moment, standing there beside my car in her red dress. She raised her hair off the back of her neck, held it, then let it drop again. Right at me, really seeing me, and she had a look about her. She'd just been laughing, but this look was sad somehow. It was as if she knew me. Then the guy put his arm around her waist, and they walked away. Silence, except for the crickets and the far-off drone of a truck. Maddie only stood there for a moment, as if dreaming with her eyes open, and then she felt something and looked back at me. "Is something wrong?" "No, except who is this guy with his arm around my wife?" She laughed a little uncertainly. "Well, I doubt if he was her boyfriend, you know. He was quite a bit older, 50 at least." So what, I thought. I myself was 40, but that didn't mean I had missed the way Maddie moved inside her dress or lifted her hair from the nape of her neck. "I mean, you're kidding, right?" "I don't really know. There's a lot of things I don't know these days, it seems. But the lady's dead in any case, so how can it matter?" Maddie was looking distressed. "If I put my foot in something, Mike, I'm sorry." "Who was the man? Do you know?" She shook her head. "I thought he was a summer person. There was that feeling about him, maybe just because he was wearing a jacket on a hot summer evening. But if he was, he wasn't staying at Warrington's. I knew most of them." "And they walked off together?" "Yes." Sounding reluctant. "Toward the parking lot?" "Yes." More reluctant still. And this time, she was lying. I knew it with a queer certainty that went far beyond intuition. It was almost like mind-reading. I reached through the window and took her hand again. "You said if I could think of anything you could do to repay me, to just ask. I'm asking. Tell me the truth, Maddie." She bit her lip, looking down at my hand lying over hers. Then she looked up at my face. He was a burly guy. The old sport coat made him look a little like a college professor, but he could have been a carpenter for all I know. His hair was black. He had a tan. They had a laugh together, a good one, and then she looked at me and the laugh went out of her face. After that, he put an arm around her and they walked away. She paused. "Not toward the parking lot, though. Toward the street." The street. From there, they could have walked north along the edge of the lake until they came to Sarah Laughs. And then, who knew? "She never told me she came down here that summer," I said. Maddie seemed to try several responses and find none of them to her liking. I gave her her hand back. It was time for me to go. In fact, I had started to wish I'd left 5 minutes sooner. "Mike, I'm sure..." "No," I said. You're not. Neither am I. But I loved her a lot, and I'm going to try and let this go. It probably signifies nothing, and besides, what else can I do? Thanks for dinner. You're welcome. Maddie looked so much like crying that I picked her hand up again and kissed the back of it. I feel like a dope. You're not a dope, I said. I gave her hand another kiss, then drove away. And that was my date, the first one in 4 years. Driving home, I thought of an old saying about how one person can never truly know another. It's easy to give that idea lip service, but it's a jolt, as horrible and unexpected as severe air turbulence on a previously calm airline flight, to discover it's a literal fact in one's own life. I kept remembering our visit to a fertility doc after we'd been trying to make a baby for almost 2 years with no success. The doctor had told us I had a low sperm count, not disastrously low, but down enough to account for Joe's failure to conceive. If you want a kid, you'll likely have one without any special help, the doc had said. Both the odds and time are still on your side. It could happen tomorrow, or it could happen 4 years from now. Will you ever fill the house with babies? Probably not, but you might have two, and you'll almost certainly have one if you keep doing the thing that makes them. She had grinned. Remember, the pleasure is in the journey. There had been a lot of pleasure, all right, many ringings of Bunter's bell, but there had been no baby. Then Joanna had died running across a shopping center parking lot on a hot day, and one of the items in her bag had been a Norco home pregnancy test, which she had not told me she had intended to buy. No more than she told me she had bought a couple of plastic owls to keep the crows from shitting on the lakeside deck. What else hadn't she told me? Stop, I muttered. For Christ's sake, stop thinking about it. But I couldn't. When I got back to Sarah, the fruit and vegetable magnets on the refrigerator were in a circle again. Three letters had been clustered in the middle, GD, and below them, O. I moved the O up to where I thought it belonged, between the G and the D, making God, or maybe an abridged version of good. Which meant exactly what? I could speculate about that, but I prefer not to, I told the empty house. I looked at Bunter the Moose, willing the bell around his moth-eaten neck to ring. When it didn't, I opened my two new magnabets and stuck them on the fridge door, spreading them out. Then I went down to the north wing, undressed, and brushed my teeth. As I bared my fangs for the mirror in a sudsy cartoon scowl, I considered calling Ward Hankins again tomorrow morning. I could tell him that my search for the elusive plastic owls had progressed from November of 1993 to July of 1994. What meetings had Joe put on her calendar for that month? What excuses to be out of Derry? And once I had finished with Ward, I could tackle Joe's friend, Bonnie Mudson, ask her if anything had been going on with Joe in the last summer of her life. Let her rest in peace, why don't you? It was the UFO voice. What good will it do you to do otherwise? Assume she popped over to the TR after one of her board meetings, maybe just on a whim, met an old friend, took him back to the house for a bite of dinner. Just dinner. And never told me, I asked the UFO voice, spitting out a mouthful of toothpaste and then rinsing. Never said a single word. How do you know she didn't? The voice returned, and that froze me in the act of putting my toothbrush back in the medicine cabinet. The UFO voice had a point. I had been deep into All the Way from the Top by July of 94. Joe could have come in and told me she'd seen Lon Chaney Jr. dancing with the Queen, doing the Werewolves of London, and I probably would have said, uh-huh, honey, that's nice, as I went on proofing copy. Bullshit, I said to my reflection. That's just bullshit. Except it wasn't. When I was really driving on a book, I more or less fell out of the world. Other than a quick scan of the sports pages, I didn't even read the newspaper. So yes, it was possible that Joe had told me she'd run over to the TR after a board meeting in Lewiston or Freeport. It was possible that she'd told me she'd run into an old friend, perhaps another student from the photography seminar she'd attended at Bates in 1991, and it was possible she told me they'd had dinner together on our deck, eating black trumpet mushrooms she'd picked herself as the sun went down. It was possible she told me these things, and I hadn't registered a word of what she was saying. And did I really think I'd get anything I could trust out of Bonnie Amundsen? She'd been Joe's friend, not mine, and Bonnie might feel the statute of limitations hadn't run out on any secrets my wife had told her. The bottom line was as simple as it was brutal. Joe was 4 years dead. Best to love her and let all troubling questions lapse. I took a final mouthful of water directly from the tap, swished it around in my mouth, and spat it out. When I returned to the kitchen to set the coffee maker for 7 a.m., I saw a new message in a new circle of magnets. It read, "Blue Rose Liar, ha ha." I looked at it for a second or two, wondering what had put it there and why, wondering if it were true. I stretched out a hand and scattered all the letters far and wide. Then I went to bed. I caught the measles when I was 8, and I was very ill. "I thought you were going to die," my father told me once, and he was not a man prone to exaggeration. He told me about how he and my mother had dunked me in a tub of cold water one night, both of them at least half convinced the shock of it would stop my heart, but both of them completely convinced that I'd burn up before their eyes if they didn't do something. I had begun to speak in a loud, monotonously discursive voice about the bright figures I saw in the room. Angels come to bear me away, my terrified mother was sure. And the last time my father took my temperature before the cold plunge, he said that the mercury on the old Johnson & Johnson rectal thermometer had stood at 106 degrees. After that, he said, he didn't dare take it any more. I don't remember any bright figures, but I remember a strange period of time that was like being in a funhouse corridor where several different movies were showing at once. The world grew elastic, bulging in places where it had never bulged before, wavering in places where it had always been solid. People, most of them seeming impossibly tall, darted in and out of my room on scissoring, cartoonish legs. Their words all came out booming with instant echoes. Someone shook a pair of baby shoes in my face. I seemed to remember my brother Siddy sticking his arm into his shirt and making repeated arm fart noises. Continuity broke down. Everything came in segments, weird wieners on a poison string. In the years between then and the summer I returned to Sarah Laughs, I had the usual sicknesses, infections, and insults to the body, but never anything like that feverish interlude when I was 8. I never expected to, believing, I suppose, that such experiences are unique to children, people with malaria, or maybe those suffering catastrophic mental breakdowns. But on the night of July 7th, in the morning of July 8th, I lived through a period of time remarkably like that childhood delirium. Dreaming, waking, moving, they were all one. I'll tell you as best I can, but nothing I say can convey the strangeness of that experience. It was as if I had found a secret passage hidden just beyond the wall of the world and went crawling along it. First there was music, not Dixieland because there were no horns, but like Dixieland, a primitive, reeling kind of bebop. 3 or 4 acoustic guitars, a harmonica, a stand-up bass, or maybe a pair. Behind all this was a hard, happy drumming that didn't sound like it was coming from a real drum. It sounded as if someone with a lot of percussive talent was whopping on a bunch of boxes. Then a woman's voice joined in, a high tenor voice, not quite mannish, roughing over the high notes. It was laughing and urgent and ominous all at the same time, and I knew at once that I was hearing Sarah Tidwell, who had never cut a record in her life. I was hearing Sarah Laughs, and man, she was rocking. "You know, we're going back to Manderley. We're gonna dance on the Sanderley. I'm gonna sing with the Banderley. We're gonna ball all we can to leave. Ball Me, Baby, Yeah. The basses, yes, there were two, broke out in a barnyard shuffle like the break in Elvis's version of Baby Let's Play House. And then there was a guitar solo, Son Tidwell playing that chicken scratch thing.